guys, Jeff here. Hope you all are getting as psyched for the main event as I am. Excited to sweat Zach. If you want to join the sweat as well, remember to follow us on social media. Our handle for Twitter and Snapchat is Just Hands Poker. We're also on Facebook, but for live, up-to-date chip porn and whatnot, check out the Snapchat and the Twitter in particular. All right, guys, thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Hello, Jack.
Hello, Zach. What's going on, man?
Just enjoying Vegas. How about yourself?
I'm enjoying the city. I was, you know, feeling kind of left out, and I had just a really monster session last night that kind of made me feel a lot better about my decision to stick here and not go to Vegas this series. So I'm in good spirits. I hear that your impending caches have not arrived yet, but I'm certain that they are in the near future. And it's not just you here today. I believe that there's a guest, not just via internet connection, but in person, in the flesh. Why don't you give him a proper introduction?
So this is a man that has gone deep in several World Series of Poker events, most notably sixth place in the Monster Stack last year. But until one of the last levels of a tournament we played 2 days ago, I just thought he was a random reg. Little did I know it was Andrew Moreno in the flesh. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Man, I'm good. It's crazy you talk about the Monster Stack because, like, Facebook, they do these reminders. It's like 1 year ago today. And so, like, yesterday it was like, made day three of the Monster Stack, and then like all friends and family and my dad's hilarious, and he's posting and he's like telling all of his friends. He's not even sure how Facebook works, and it's hilarious. But so yeah, and then today was the update today was the final table, so it was just cool to look back and remember it all.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I heard you talk about like enjoying Vegas, and I was like, man, by enjoying you mean like melting out here. It's been epically hot this summer. So
yeah, no, I mean, Jack, I think you definitely made the wrong decision. Like being able to make thousands of dollars in a soft cash game a few blocks away from your house versus just like playing tournaments and not cashing. Like I think I got the better end of this last few weeks, but you know, we can agree to disagree.
Yeah, well, I've got it good.
So this hand is coming from a tournament at Binion's. It is an $850 buy-in tournament. It had 3 day ones, Sunday, Monday, and yesterday. Today's Wednesday, and today is the day two, and then the final table is on Thursday. The structure, I mean, you probably know more about this than me, but just from kind of looking at the available structures for this price point, I didn't see a tournament like this whole summer that came remotely close to how solid the structure was in terms of just what the average like big blind would be at 8 hours in, 12 hours in. What do you think about it?
I have like some interesting thoughts about it because I'm a part of this like poker group that we do a lot of studying and we talk Skype, and there's like, it's a pretty big group of locals. There's about 20 of us. And I was like, I actually after a hand that you played, we don't have to get into it, but you know, like in a tournament like this, you'll see like a lot of really big mistakes. And I saw somebody get in like a lot of chips in like a limped pot against you. And I just like kind of texted my friends. I was like, man, there's just like, this is like poker, you know, circa 2002, you know, like it's crazy. And it's like, so yeah, I mean, there's definitely a ton of value there. Like the field is like, you know, it's pretty soft, but my mixed feelings come more in the form of like I've been playing pretty big cash games and like a lot of bigger buy-in tournaments. And I was like, yeah, I mean, this will be good value. This looks like a great structure, but then I'm kind of realizing now like the opportunity cost of like sitting in a tournament like this where, you know, the first place prize and second place prize, you know, is not going to be very big. And, I mean, relatively speaking, in a lot of the games that I've been playing. So I'm like, man, I really have to like win or get second in order to not feel really dirty about this. And I put myself in a situation where I'm going to have to play like a lot of long hours like really patiently. So I think there's a ton of value, and it is a great structure and it is like very soft, as I mentioned. But I don't know if I had a chance to, you know, register the tournament, if I still would have registered it. But I mean, I'm day two with like one of the chip leaders. So that's obviously like, you know, we're in it.
Yeah.
Definitely in it. Yeah.
No, that sounds nice.
Yeah, I obviously, like, I won this, like, really large hand off Zach. Just really briefly, my wife is at the final table of a Venetian event, and I'm sitting in this tournament, like, kind of miserable. And I'm just thinking, like, all right, let's gamble it up. Let's just get in there. Like, let's flop draws, and let's, like, put all the money in. Zach, as you know, like, I got in a not great draw against a very strong hand and hit it. And so that's why I'm at day two, and you're, you know, sitting over here without your cash or whatever. So... But you were still gracious enough to invite me into your home, so I appreciate that.
Well, I do that with everyone that gets me out of a tournament.
Nice. Okay, I just have to check my tires when I leave. Okay.
Yeah.
That
hand was not particularly interesting. I mean, I think we could talk about whether to call or raise the flop, but I think with your consideration of the fact that you wanted to gamble, it becomes a pretty clear, like, overall positive expected value decision, even if one could argue that it might be better to call that particular board texture. We did play some pretty interesting hands. Two that I wrote down before even thinking that I'd be able to get you on the podcast. Just like, wow, this is one of the most interesting hands I've played in a while. Talk it over with Jack.
Yeah.
So we start this hand with approximately like 220K effective. And you are, I think, covering me by a little bit. This is
what's the blind level?
It's 1,500, 3,000.
Okay. Yeah, and you're going to find, like, some really interesting spots and when you have two, like, competent players in a tournament when they're that deep. And, you know, that was one thing that I thought was cool and still think is cool about registering the tournament is, like, the nature of the long, deep stack play. And, yeah, this hand is definitely a good one.
Yeah. So I'm in the big blind, and Andrew is under the gun plus two. And he makes it 7,500, and it folds to me in the big blind, and I have the A7 of diamonds. So I don't think there's much to talk about here against, again, at the time, just kind of random, likely Las Vegas, local pro. There's no real value in 3-betting A7 of diamonds. I'm going to have much better 3-bet light candidates, and with the price I'm getting, it's just... very, very clear call on the big blind.
Yeah, I guess one thing I would kind of mention before is, like, the way I see, like, tournament poker, because I'm a cash game guy, and, like, I play, you know, mostly during the summer, I'll play, like, 10 tournaments usually is, like, per year.
Yeah.
But I'm really fascinated by a lot of the dynamics that, like, unfold and some of the interesting situations that can occur. And I think, like, the way I view tournaments is that and I think that people make a big mistake in general. Like, they're looking more at, like, you know, they want to play tight and solid, and they know, like, how to play maybe 20, 30 big blinds. But I think one thing that kind of misses people is they're, like, understanding that this is a game, and it's like a very specific kind of game where you really want to focus in on, like, who is sitting where with how many big blinds, like, at all given times, and, like, who's capable, who's not. And, you know, so, like, you really want to be aware of whose big blinds that you're attacking and who's going to be in position. And, you know, that's one thing I was really aware of was that you were the only, you know, good player at the table, I would say. And so I really want to be very mindful of, like, how I attack your big blind. You know, I don't want to just, like, you know, get up in there with, like, random hands and just, like, think that I'm just going to, like, come at you super deep and just, like, outplay you. I think that's, like, a big mistake. But I guess I just wanted to highlight how important I think it is to really recognize all the factors in the game that I think, and they actually matter a lot more too as the tournament progresses, where, like, you can be opening in spots where, like, the players behind you, like, just, like, you can be basically opening any two at some point, and sometimes, like, you have no options available to you because, like, the big stack on your right, who's good, is, like, opening and taking all your spots away.
Exactly, yeah.
So anyway, yeah, so I just wanted to note that I think like, I'm generally not going to be attacking your big blind too wide here, so just from on my end.
Yeah, and I thought that too, because when you use a size of 7,500, that wasn't your standard sizing. So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, he's basically, you know, when he's using this larger sizing, he's a good enough player that even if it's not so much because of my big blind, he's going to have a stronger range here. So that makes the even consideration of 3-betting a suited ace even, I think, a worse... Like if you use that sizing, given that you were using other sizings before, and I had, like, ace 4 suited, ace 5 suited, some of my best 3-bet bluffing candidates, I think in the moment I would have considered a call, because the sizing was, like,
yeah, kind
of threw me off a little bit.
And that's good, and that's, like, what I would hope for, because I think, you know, like, I want to you know, disincentivize you to defend your big blind as much. Mm-hmm. And also I want to be opening a stronger range. So, you know, using a larger sizing is exactly why I did what I did.
Happy to be at the bottom of that stronger range, but
yeah, no, yeah, but still, I mean, you know, course, like, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, remind me of what seat did Andrew open from?
He was under the gun plus two. It was nine-handed at this time. All seats were filled, and I was in the big blind. So I call, and the now there's 21K total in the pot with all the antes and everything, and the flop is the 6-8-9 with one diamond. So I flop ace high, an open-ended straight draw, and a backdoor flush draw. So I think there is an argument for having a leading range on this board, but I think this hand specifically plays very well as a check call. For almost any sizing, my hand alone is, you know, is going to have enough equity right now to continue in the hand. And there's just a lot of good turn cards where I could continue to check call, potentially check raise. Yeah, I think this is a pretty clear check intending to call almost any sizing from my perspective.
A couple questions from you from your perspective. One, is Andrew ever limping from, you know, this sort of moderately early position?
No, he rarely limped in this tournament. Yeah, I actually, maybe after we do this hand, I think a discussion about limping earlier on would be interesting. But yeah, at this point, I think I would expect a limp a very small percentage of the time, only maybe if there's like a 1 to 2 sub 10 big blind stacks or something.
You said it was 865? Or 689?
689, yeah.
Okay. And do you think Andrew's going to be playing or opening 6-8 suited from this position?
No. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm kind of clouded because I know I ended up seeing his hand. But yeah, I mean, you're going to say your hand. So he ended up having queen 10 suited in this hand. And I would say, like, from my perspective, that's like the stone bottom of like that type of hand category range. Like, I think in the moment I probably would have thought, given his sizing, it would be like queen jack suited and not queen 10 suited with jack 10 suited, and queen 10 suited would be like maybe but probably not from my perspective.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, you mentioned the possibility of leading here, which I don't think it's crazy. I would like leading a lot better on the aforementioned 865 board, since I think you can much more plausibly represent 9-7 than 5-7, which I think maybe you would fold a 5-7 suited or 3-bet.
Oh, I'm not folding 5-7 suited. I'm going to fold 7-5 offsuit for that sizing, but
I'll certainly.
Fold, yeah. Yeah.
Well, against an early position open, are there antes at this point?
Yes, there are.
Sorry. Oh, there are?
Okay. Yeah, it's 1,500, 3,000 with $500 antes. The antes are pretty big, so it's, you know, 1/6 yeah. of the stack. So that, sorry for not mentioning that.
All right. Well, I think leading is reasonable, especially since it allows you to be the aggressor and maybe in a slightly lower variance way. I don't think you're getting raised here that often. And, you know, if you're going to put in a few bets and try and get a fold, it might be better, since you can plausibly have, you know, several value combos that Andrew can't have. I think leading easily could be the best play if you're trying to limit your variance against a better player.
I guess the way that I see it too is like, I mean, really, I think it just comes down to a lot of like, you know, like your board and my board. And I think this is like a really your board kind of hand, which would allow you to, you know, like do a number of things like check raise, bet, just lead, check call. But especially that we're deep, I think you just, you know, have more options available to you. And I think I just can't see, like, if you think, and it's hard, these are the things that are really challenging is like, and I struggle with this against you in the second hand that we played, is like, all I know is there's this kid who like seems to be making good decisions in this tournament where everyone's making bad decisions. So like, good is a very relative term.
Exactly. Yeah. So like, yeah, I mean, because there were several people I've played with like very similar, like if I described you physically, it would describe X amount of people in the room, but you're obviously playing on a much more sophisticated level. And actually, I think a mistake I've made a few times in Vegas during the series before is overestimating people that look competent, mm-hmm. basically, you know?
Yeah, it's like a big thing in live poker that we talk a lot about on our coaching calls. Like, people just are never as good as you think they are. And the people that, I mean, and this is just comes from like a lot of like, because we know a lot of the local like high stakes cash game players.
Yeah.
Like, we know who like the guys are that are really good, and they're just not that many. And in a tournament where like we're going to have like very short samples, small samples, like it's going to be really difficult to assess like what good actually means. And so,
yeah,
you know, I think, you know, given that you think I'm good, like I'm just probably not raising this like board texture with like, I mean, I'm like going to be super nutted when I do, when we're as deep as we are. And, you know, or like have like a tremendous amount of equity, but still, I don't think that like that's a spot I would want to put myself into versus like a board that's going to have favor you in so many ways. So,
well, given that, then I like leading the best.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to, I feel like it, I think leading is like an interesting conversation too, because it really puts me in like a defensive mode where, it opens up spots for you to like just continue with aggression and, you know, bluff me off some hands, as well as like remove like the initiative from me, which I think is like so important in poker, having the initiative, which and I don't lead often, but I'm always open to spots, and this seems like a spot that could be very useful.
Well,
yeah, I just think the stacks, if you check call the flop, then I think to try and take away the pot on the turn, you're just going to be committing a lot of chips.
Yeah.
So, and you could always call flop lead turn, but I guess I would, if you're going to do that, I would just rather lead the flop.
Yeah, I'm convinced on leading the flop, especially when I'm thinking a little bit more, which I wasn't thinking through as much as I should in the moment, about like chip utility, where like, you know, making a like a half pot lead and like a half to third pot lead on the turn doesn't really change like my chip utility, but like check calling the flop and like check raising the turn, whether I like turn a straight or turn additional equity in the form of a diamond or something, like that puts a lot of my chips at risk. And if I then lose after making a check raise on the turn after check calling the flop, or like if I check raise the turn with like, I probably wouldn't check raise the turn, I would have thought through it with a diamond, because then I would have to raise fold a really high equity hand.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm definitely behind the lead, but I check called.
Well, also, we check, like, even the thought of, like, check raising the turn, like, when you make your 10, like, there's still, like, one very possible straight that I could have in my range, which is the nuts, you know, when we're that deep.
Yes.
So, like, check raising that card gets, like, really, it gets really sticky, you know, when we're as deep as we are. Like, it would be, like, an absolute disaster to bust, like, I mean, I don't know, almost, I don't, maybe 100 big blinds close to that, 75, I don't remember what it was. With
yeah,
queen jack versus
yeah.
Versus like just a naked seven, that would be like, so you want to keep that into account too, like when you actually like hit and you want to like get that check raise in.
Yeah, I would like check calling better, I think, if we had a better implied odd situation. But when you hit your straight, there's gonna be a four card straight on the board, and I don't think you're getting that much more money from an overpair.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. So I check. Andrew, you know, as you said, has the queen 10 suited. I believe you have a backdoor flush draw. Mm-hmm. And you bet, let me see what sizing you did. And you bet 10K and a 21K.
Mm-hmm.
It seems pretty standard to me, if
yeah.
you want to maybe talk
I
about
mean,
it.
I could, typically, like, the way I vary my bet sizing, I think, is probably like most, which is I kind of like standard on a half pot, and as the board gets progressively wet or like dry, I tend to go like less than half or more than half, up to like three quarters, sometimes even full pot, depending on how wet the board is, and all the way down to like, you know, one quarter, depending on how dry. And I think like, I think most sophisticated players use this basic strategy. So this board is like definitely coordinated. I wouldn't call it like super wet, mm-hmm. but I think I wouldn't mind a slightly larger bet sizing based on that, but I think it's pretty close.
Okay. Yeah, and for the listeners, so Andrew is double gutted here. So the 7 will give him a straight, and the jack will give him the nuts. Yeah. So I check call 10K, so the turn now has 41,000 in it, and we're at a little over 200,000 in effective stacks behind. And the turn is an offsuit 10. So now the board is 6, 8, 9, 10. And I turn to straight. And here's where I think, if I'm check calling this board, not just with my exact hand, but this is a card I really need to be leading out on. Because I just have... I don't know if I have all the 7s because I'm folding some offsuit 7 combos preflop, but I have significantly more 7s than Andrew has. And I also want to be able to, if I check called, like if I have a set here, I'm not check raising in this spot on this board. So I wanted a bet of sizing where I can get a cheap price with my bluffs and get value from hands that are, you know, get value with my hands that are worse than a straight, like sets and maybe my better two pairs. So I opted to lead 12K into 41K. So basically like one quarter pot. I also think that I don't know enough about Andrew at this time, but I think like the general read I had, which was probably a little bit off, is that you're not looking to get into spots with me. But if you feel like, I feel like you're thinking the same thing that I'm thinking, where it's like, I'm not looking to get into spots with you. So if I make kind of this blocking bet type thing, I think there's like some percentage of the time that someone with your description and what I know about you at the time will like be over bluffing after mm-hmm. that bet sizing. Mm-hmm. So that's why I chose kind of the relatively small bet sizing with my hand.
I think I like a larger bet sizing from you. Mostly just because, like, first of all, when I see bet this board, and we kind of mentioned this, you know, off stream or whatever after the hand, but like when I see bet this board, after where I opened from, like there's a reasonable amount of hands that I'm like, just going to like check back and give you credit for like hitting your range pretty well. As I mentioned, I feel like this, you're going to have a lot of hands that hit this board. And, so like when I see bet, I think that I'm going to definitely like have connected with this board in some way. And when you lead on the turn, I can't really, like, I have a lot of hands that I'm going to need to continue with still, but like that I'm not going to want to bet myself.
Yeah.
You know? And, so I would like a slightly larger bet sizing. Also, it really kind of sucks on my end too, because I feel like this board, like it's hard for me to find like natural bluffs for you or like hands that like I can really beat. So I think you're just going to be getting like value from me a lot mm-hmm. here. Like, and I'm going to have to call at least once versus like, because I think you're going to like lead this turn a lot, even with like some of your weaker parts of that range. And the smaller sizing, I guess, does like lead me to believe that it's possible you do have some of those weaker hands, like maybe hands like two pair, you know, like a hand like 8-7 or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think regardless, like when you led, I was like, it was pretty annoying spot for me because I can't really fold. And I'm on the defensive, and I know like I leave myself open to get bluffed a lot. Like I had to fold so many rivers.
Yeah.
And it's like just kind of a crappy spot for me, but given the price too, it's a pretty easy call, I think.
It's a rainbow flop, right?
Yes. And the turn completed the rainbow.
Yeah. Well, I think with, you know, Andrew's exact hand, it's a pretty trivial call. I think like if you had a hand like kings, I would be strongly considering just folding now, especially if Zach makes like a half pot bet. I'm trying to think of, I mean, what does Zach's bluffing range look like here?
I'll tell you, it's a lot of just suited aces with backdoor flush draws.
That you're going to check call on the flop?
Yeah, I'm not, for a half pot bet, ace high with a backdoor flush draw against Andrew, I think I'd be getting exploited pretty hard if I fold that hand, those hands.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think also, like the board texturally, I think like, you know, as I alluded to earlier, like this is a spot where like I'm pretty content to just like play pretty passively and, uh-huh. and give up quite a bit, just because I typically don't fight very hard for spots where there's not a lot of money in the middle and I don't really have much equity and I'm against an opponent that I think is like hit a board reasonably well. Mm-hmm. I give up very easily. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just like me being transparent now. So I would tend to agree with Jack that, you wouldn't be really getting exploited here. Cool. Not for me. Yeah.
So yeah, I guess, I mean, knowing this now, I can definitely get behind a bigger bet sizing. I still think in the moment with what I knew, maybe I can go a little bit bigger, maybe like 15 or 16K into 41. But like, I'm using a bet sizing there where like, if he's folding kings, I'm screwing up, you know? Like, mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Versus that sizing, like it's really tempting to want to call with my overpairs, but I'd like to think I would just fold, but it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Well, you're never folding queens or jacks.
Yeah, no, no.
But yeah, aces and kings, I think, are just like, man, this board is just so shitty for your range. Like, you have to fold. And I think it really shouldn't matter that much what the sizing is, which is why I like bumping up to half pot. I mean, like, you can't go too big because you just have such a massive range advantage. But I think the Andrew's range is probably pretty well delineated between, like, anything like with a 10 plus can beat a bluff. And so if I have a 10 plus and some way to improve, I'll continue on this board that's really terrible for me. Plus you're going to have all queen jack probably.
Well, queen jack
suited. Queen jack suited, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think since it's going to be, in my opinion, a pretty natural delineation between what should continue and what shouldn't. And I think both of those ranges will be fairly price insensitive from a lot of players. I'm not saying that Andrew's necessarily going to play like this, but I think a lot of players, one, maybe wouldn't give up kings for the 20,000 anyway. And if they are going to give up kings and aces, but not queens and jacks, because they can handle that level, they'll probably be pretty price insensitive to the range that they were going to continue with. Mm. I just think there's not that many players who are going to like call kings for 10,000 and not 20,000. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, I mean,
I definitely can see that I might be wrong there.
I think you convinced me. It's really hard to know. Again, it's just like what Andrew said before. It's like we've seen, he seems like by far very like the most competent player at the table. And my sample size of like hands he's actually played is just very limited. Hasn't really gotten a showdown. So,
yeah. And the way I'm going to interpret this sizing, you know, again, like just being transparent now is like, I think it's really consistent with, just like linear hand strength, you know, and I think you're going to have like some like two pairs, like even some sets,
mm-hmm.
You know, with this sizing, like you're not like trying to rep a straight on me here by betting like three quarters or something.
Yeah.
Like that's how I'm going to interpret like larger bet sizings is like basically like more nutted hands and like less, you know, linear type hands, like I like bottom two pair and stuff like that. So.
Cool. So I bet the 10, the 12K, and Andrew calls. So we're seeing a river with now 65K in the pot, and with an SPR of like a little under 3, and it is a jack. So now the final board reads out.
Yeah, run good, baby.
So the final board is 6, 8, 9, 10 jack, 65K in the pot, and I'm thinking here. It's like okay. Basically, like, in his range of hands that just check call, I mean, just call the turn, like, how many queens does he have compared to, like, one pair and two pair hands? And basically, in the moment, I decided that he has just, like, a lot more, like, one pair, two pair hands here than queens. Like, I think he has pocket queens. I think he'll definitely, you know, flat call some of the time with the nuts with queen jack. And again, I wasn't really, really putting queen 10 in your range. So you really don't have that many queens that play this way. So mm-hmm. I was thinking it's not too thin to get some value. And I wanted to pick a sizing where I thought again, like based on your description to a small sizing twice, I thought you're going to be fairly bluff happy. So I was basically planning on doing I do this bet sometimes in cash games. I mean, more often cash games than tournaments, like all the time I've done in a tournament, where it's like I bet a smaller sizing with like a near top of the range but not complete top of the range value hand where I could conceivably get called by worse, but pick a sizing where I think someone who's capable of bluffing might choose to bluff it and bet that intending to call a reasonably sized raise. Mm-hmm. So I bet 18K into 65 intending on calling a reasonably sized raise.
I think against almost any player I think you would encounter in this tournament, and I think Andrew might be like the one exception, but I wouldn't be thinking that at the time, is that I would be choosing between bet fold and check fold, because I just don't think many players are good enough to turn kings into a bluff here, or even like, yeah, I don't think you're getting bluffed enough to call. So first of all, that's just where I'm coming from, and so my decision with the evidence I have right now is between bet fold and check fold, and I like the exploitatively small bet fold. I think a lot of players who seem like they're good call too much with like bluff catchers, so I like it. I like the line, but I would fold to a raise.
Yeah, for what it's worth, any other player at the table and vast majority of other players in the tournament, I think bet folding is going to be the best play here. But I just, you know, I thought that, I mean, not that you're not capable of it, but I guess in the moment, given the information, you're going to be under bluffing this sizing, right?
I mean, knowing myself, like, I mean, a few years ago, like, you're just printing here by betting. I typically like go after like a lot of spots. Like I probably overbluff. Like as just real briefly, like my background is live. Like I've been playing live. I've started online, but it was like, you know, basically like the last 12, 13 years have all been live. Yeah. And I have like some online training and coaches that come from that background. But so basically like everything to me is like, you know, like I sense weakness, and there's a lot of like exploitative, like not as like streamlined thought process traditionally. And that's why I said a few years ago, like I'm just like jumping all over things like this. But I think in this spot now, like knowing myself as a player, like I'm going to definitely be bluffing like a pretty small frequency, basically with hands that have like, I mean, I guess, I mean, I'm just trying to think of like a hand that has a blocker, but like probably not, because like maybe if I had somehow like a king in my hand, but I don't think like I'm not going to try to rep king queen here, you know? So I think basically given like what I know of you and the line that you've taken, like I'm just going to, I'm not going to, I mean, if I have like tens, like I'll consider calling. But that's pretty much like the only hand that I might bluff catch with, or think that you could possibly be like betting like sevens or eights or nines for the sizing, mm-hmm. you know, using the smaller sizing. But I just don't see myself really just like, because I know, I mean, like obviously like the sizing that you're using in this board, and it's obviously like a pretty bad river card for you, like for your range as a whole.
Yes.
And probably better for me. Mm-hmm. So I think given that you know that, and you're using this sizing, I don't think that, I don't know. I feel like I get called here a lot when I make this, like this bluff. Like if I just have like 10-9 or something, or like Jack 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I just don't want to call those hands. I would just fold those.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Zach, I think you also like, you could have close to all combos of Queen Jack at this point too. So,
oh yeah.
Do you think I think you play them the same way. So I don't think there's that much incentive to bluff. It's not like you're super capped, especially because I don't think either of you ever really have King Queen. So, I think the Queen is basically the nuts.
Yeah, you have like pretty much all like offsuit combos of Queen Jack, whereas I only have the suited ones. I mean, depending on like, I mean, I don't know if you check peel Queen Jack, but I imagine that you probably do.
Oh yeah, yeah. For half pot sizing, yeah, 100%, yeah.
So I mean, I think you're pretty well protected here with a river bet when you do. So if it were me personally, I would probably check decide river in the same situation, just because like, I don't think, like, I would have to look for, like, natural bluffs, and I think most of them contain, like, value hands. They're like, you know, maybe two pairs and stuff like that. And I don't know if I expect my opponent to really be like turning those hands into a bluff very much. And it's a really tough spot. I mean, I don't know, like maybe I'm bluffing a lot when check two with like two pair and stuff. But I think like you just have to look at the sizing and think about like, you know, what price are you getting? Like, what bluffs do I have? Am I the kind of player that's going to like check back two pair or a set here and expect to win some frequency? And the big thing that like we talked about, you know, off stream was that, like the chip utility of like putting in this raise size and you calling, you know, like anytime you, and this is such a huge concept in poker, in tournament poker, where you want to really look at, like the ramifications of like putting in a certain amount of chips. Like
yeah.
We started this hand with 70 big blinds. Like if I make this raise, what did I make it on the, cause 55, I raised
55K. Yeah.
Yeah. I made it like 55,000, you know, like, you maybe put yourself in like a 20, 25 big blind category where your options become significantly fewer than if you are, you know, 50, 60 big blinds or whatever it would be if you check fold river. So you want to look at your chip utility and the implications of like putting in a large amount of chips because, and this is like a good concept, I think, in general, and I'm sure it's been talked about a lot, but like you want to basically like, when I'm like value raising, like I want to leave you with as much like chip utility as I can, within reason. And when I'm bluffing, like I want to kind of attack it in the same way where you realize that like this is going to be like a pivotal point in your tournament. That yeah. If you're wrong, like all of a sudden, like you're not like flatting very many opens. You have yep. to tighten your ranges a lot. You know, like the game's going to totally change for you. So,
and I guess for me that like. I was thinking about that and mm-hmm. thought like just given how, and again, you don't have as many natural bluffs, but I thought that just given how good of a spot it is based on my bet sizing and that it kind of looked weak and small, and that if you were to raise, it puts me in a tough spot. I just thought a player of your description is going to overbluff that spot mm-hmm. with the information, you know?
And that's why it makes it interesting.
Yeah.
I do think like, if you think he's going to be overbluffing, and I would rather just check call.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say that next. Like, as I was listening to Andrew talk about the check call, it's like, that makes perfect sense because then I'm still getting that value. I'm probably getting more value if he's someone who's going to overbluff, he's probably going to be more inclined to overbluff a check than overbluff a small bet, mm-hmm. even if he is overbluffing the smaller bet. And that reduces my variance in a tournament against the other, you know, the best player at the table where... Yeah, so I think I definitely screwed up the river, and it's a check call. In the moment when I finished the hand, I was like, I probably made a mistake on the river, but I'm really not sure.
Yeah, and the other thing you have to consider, is, like I played this tournament yesterday, this 2K at Planet Hollywood, and I randomly got sat at like the only bad table, and I was like, whatever, it's fine, you know. And I chose this spot to gamble where I felt like it was like very reasonable, and I gambled with an up flush draw and lost, and... Like, I wouldn't have done that at the Binion's table, you know? Like, honestly, like, you really need to look at, like, what kind of a spot are you in? Like, you have one good player at the table, and you have, like, everyone else that is, like, having a hard time spelling poker, you know? So, it's like, you want to minimize your variance in a pretty close spot, keep the pot small, you know, in a spot where you don't have a hand that loves to, like, call a big raise on the river. And maybe even give up a little bit of equity by checking, even if you are, let's just say that you are theoretically, to play like deep with these players that you're going to be able to exploit massively.
Yeah, for sure.
And don't you love cash?
Yeah.
You have to
deal with that. Yeah.
Just go for it. Yeah.
So yeah, what I told Andrew after at the break, whatever, maybe 20, 30 minutes after we played that hand, and there was another hand we played shortly before that hand. I was like, yeah, I come from a cash game background where it's just that kind of spot and thinking about chip utility. Like I definitely had it on my mind, but I'm nowhere near the level of nuance that I should be for these spots. And Andrew's like, yeah, I'm cash too. Like, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it was a really fun tournament.
Did you decide not to play it the next day or?
Yeah. So for the listeners, this was my second tournament in Vegas. I played a third tournament. I played the Gary Deep Stack, the Monster Stack, and four Sit and Goes. I'm still cashless, but I've done decent in the last longers. It was originally online 14 hours of poker with 2 hours and 40 minutes of breaks in between, so 11 a.m. to 3:40 a.m. if you get there. And then after the first day one, they decided to make it a little more reasonable and have it go from what would be 11 a.m. to like 1:15. Uh-huh. And now we're at like 12, 05, 12:10, and Andrew busts me. And here I am having played 12 hours of poker. I won a $500 last longer, which was good. But, you know.
With John?
No, not with John.
Okay.
With probably a future podcast guest, so we'll leave that kind of in a...
Okay.
You know, it'll be good for you.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, I mean, he's expressed interest, so
He's entertaining.
But yeah, so after playing like 12 hours of poker, not cashing, and just like losing like a questionable spot to Andrew, and then losing in just like a really annoying and not questionable spot to Andrew, I was just like, I don't want to... Like, I got home at 1 a.m. I don't want to be back at Binion's at 11. And given that I doubled up and got someone to put in 320 big blinds with pocket kings on 9-jack-queen... Yeah, in a limp pot. I felt that, like, if I'm going to play it, I have to get there at 11.
Mm-hmm. There's just so much value to get there at 11.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got there at, like, 11:30 or something? Like,
I got there, yeah. I don't know. Something like that.
Like, yeah, but you were at our table, like, very shortly after it started. I think that hand happened like a few hands into when you sat down.
It did, yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, good value tournament, but I'm still working on my mental game to be able to like just feel really excited and passionate about tournaments after that happens, knowing intellectually full well that like I'm very happy with my play. Like this one questionable spot with Andrew was like really like, you know, probably by far my biggest mistake in the tournament. And like, if that's the case, that's fine. Like, whatever. It's just no fun to play for a really long time, make what I feel like is really good decisions in new situations, and then leave like tired with my back hurting without any money.
That's tournament poker life, man.
I know.
Like, it's kind of the way, but you know where it balances out? It's like, the best way I can describe it is like when you like fall in love, you know, and you like have that like that rush and like you just remember it's like it's insane and it's like amazing and all these great things, is like the final table of the Monster Stack. You know, it's like remembering that experience of like having my entire family on the rail and like I couldn't even have my phone because it was like blowing up so much, and like the experience that's generated. Like, I was chip leader of that tournament for like a good portion. I just had like this insane stack and was like winning every hand, and it's like this major tournament for like over $1 million, and like the experience that was generated from that fuels me to like come to the tournaments and like, you know, like I'm like kind of chasing that in a way, you know, and like chasing that win or whatever. But like once you get a taste of like a deep run or like a real meaningful tournament experience, I think it allows you to grind through a lot of those like boring stages and like whatever moments, knowing that, you know, that because I've had that experience, and I know, you know, maybe if you haven't had it yet, like, but once you get a taste of it, I feel like it kind of gives you the tournament bug.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I really haven't romanticized kind of like the deep run because I've just primarily played cash. But since I decided to come to the series this year and like do the tournaments, kind of in the week or two leading up to it, I was like, wow, you know, I could make life-changing money. I can go deep in a bracelet event. Like, that's just something that wasn't on the table ever before for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's cool. I'm probably going to play a little bit less of the tournament schedule that I was going to play, but just kind of continue to study it and really just, you know, bink the main. So that's the plan for the rest of my series.
Dude, that's every poker player's plan B. Just bink the main.
Yeah. So Andrew, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the table talk at Binion. So you had your headphones in for some of it, but I don't know if you were like maybe just not listening to music and just listening and doing that thing, because I do that a lot. But yeah, there was some kind of ridiculous banter going on at that table.
You expect that at the Binions. You know, like, it's
I've never been, I don't know.
It's this, like, old school vibe with, like, you know, just, like, that old Vegas feel. Like, when you just look at the walls and the decor, you just feel like you're in 1970.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think, like, for example, this one guy, I mean, he starts talking just about, like, you know, the problem with Mexico and, like, you know, like, all these, like, world topic views that are, like, typically, like, highly controversial. Like, he just knows and he has the answers. And so, like, I mean, I've been playing live poker for a long time. And, like, I do a lot of, like, personal development work. And I think a lot about, like how do I get the desired result or whatever. And, like what's going to create, you know, like, this negative energy or positive energy. And granted, I've been stressed out lately. I'm having a rough summer playing big, you know, big pots and stuff. So, but I think the best way to approach these kind of things was, like, I chimed in and just said one thing to the guy, basically just tried to offer a new perspective. And I think anytime you, like, try to make someone wrong, right, because they have their belief and they're like, oh, this is how it is. And I'm like, actually, that's not how it is. This is how it is, which is typically how a lot of arguments go, especially, like, politically or religious or whatever.
Yeah.
I basically just try to say, like, okay, that's not wrong. But, like, think about how these people, like, think about the world that they live in. You know, and so give him something to think about rather than tell him, like, this is how it is. So, I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to do, because otherwise, nobody wants to sit there during that. Like, it's uncomfortable and it's like...
Really, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the people talking do, I don't know. Like, maybe the guy with the Make America Great Again hat didn't mind the conversation.
Yeah, that guy. Oh, man.
But, yeah, no, I mean, it for what it's worth, the exact conversation was this guy from Canada... was here and was just kind of talking about how Canadian American values are similar, but Mexican values must be very different because the lack of value on life over there. And, you know,
Jesus.
just to clarify, like, I'm half Mexican. My dad is Mexican. Okay. My last name means dark skin in Spanish.
Okay.
So, like, it definitely, you know, I'm Turkish, Mexican, and I feel, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't angered by it. I just felt like it was this ignorance of, like, someone that, like, you know, watches the news and, like, just judges, like, based on what he sees.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, my family actually came from there, and I've been down there numerous times recently even. And I just know that it's, like, a different way of life where, like, people are really struggling to survive.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, it is dangerous and there's cartels and all these other, like, crazy things, but just as a general, like, it's this, like, separate than mentality that, like, really bothers me. It's like, oh, no, but, like, I'm different than them because I live in this country and, like, we're different. We yeah. think differently. Whereas I don't really see it that way. Like, I see, like, I know this sounds, like, cheesy or whatever, like, we're all the same. But, like, you know, environmental factors, you know, and, like, the things, like, put yourself in their shoes, like, empathy. Think yeah. about this, you know, and that's all I was really trying to do. But, yeah, I mean, definitely that kind of stuff. Is bothersome for sure.
Yeah, and it's, I almost, like, I had kind of an interesting moment there because I've gotten, when I first started playing poker, I would try to, like, chime in the same vein that you are, not trying to prove someone wrong, but just, you know, put another point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert, didn't always go so well.
Yeah.
And I kind of just got numb to these type of conversations at the poker table. And then I heard someone who basically hasn't said a word so far looked like a pro, said something just, like, really, like, intelligent and compassionate, and was like, oh, like, what am I doing? Like, I, you know, have, like, spent a year, like, working for, like, a human rights organization and, like, feel very passionate about politics, and I haven't said anything at the poker table for months. Like, maybe I need to reevaluate this, like, and how to go about it. And it's really tough, you know, because, like, it's not like I... you know, abhor or have any negative feelings for these people. Like, they've come to their views for why they've come to their views, and, like, it's whatever. I disagree with, you know, some of them, but
mm-hmm.
like, a lot of these people that espouse, not like that particular political point of view, but espouse politics at the table, tend to be the type of people that just, like, you know the right answer and aren't really interested in discussing. It's more of, like, telling people that haven't gotten on their level yet.
Yeah.
So it's really tough to kind of, like, balance that, and then, like, you know, maybe you say something and then, like, it really, like, the last conversation I remember having, real conversation at the poker table, was the terrorist attack in Norway, like three or four years ago. It was like a mass shooting, mm-hmm. and this guy was like that's why I'm happy we're like in America, like the safest country in the world. And I'm just like, yeah, man, like, you know, like I wasn't like you're wrong. I was like, America is great. Like I I'm really happy to be from here and very lucky. But like, if there's one thing we need to work on, it's like, you know, lowering our like incident of gun violence, which is like, I'm not sure if it's the highest or just one of the highest of what's considered like the developed world, but it's nothing to be proud of. Yeah. And he just like goes off. He's like, I'm in the military. You're going to tell me I'm wrong about security. And then this is when it devolves and I'm like, yes, like,
yeah,
it's not, you know,
because now you're in emotion and like, yeah. When people get into the emotion, the logic's part of the brain, like tends to like take a back seat and the rush of like blood pressure and like all that, like kind of takes over.
Yeah. So yeah, it's tough. And then one of my, friend of the show, politics professor, Dave, was on an earlier episode. He, you know, rightly so, he writes and thinks and teaches about politics for a living. He's great at the table, but I've seen him getting into some arguments with people in the DC area, and I enjoy it as a spectator, but I imagine it definitely makes it harder to like stay focused and play good poker, which ultimately is how I've justified staying silent at the table. Mm-hmm. Just being like, if I let this kind of get to me and I focus on this, that's less time that I'm like observing physical tells, timing tells, you know, I don't know. Yeah. It's a balance to strike.
I feel like a lot, just to say this real briefly, like I really see myself as like kind of a teacher. Like I coach a lot in poker and I've been mm-hmm. in poker for a long time. I'm like a pro's pro, you know. I wanna create an environment and a space for like the recreational players as well as the professionals.
Yeah.
That is like very warm and open and welcoming. And I also have this belief that like, you know, as I've aged and like the thing that is like really important to me is to just be who I say I am, you know, and like I don't have to like act a certain way or do a certain thing. But if I'm like passionate about something or I believe in something, like I'm going to be it in like a very responsible way. And I think the poker table is actually a really great place to express a lot about who we are as people. And I've definitely used it to you know, get certain things across that I really believe about poker. Like, for example, the other day I was playing in this like high stakes cash game where like five handed with one fish, and time comes and the fish says I'm done, and everybody's snap is done. This is like 3 a.m.
That shit still happens.
Yeah. And then, so then like no one says anything. I was like, I'm playing, like, let's play. And then the guy leaves and the guy even says something. Right. And then they're all just kind of like, whatever. And then they're going to leave. And I was like, no guys, I was like, this is not okay, you know? And I sat there and preached to these regs and I told them, I was like, you know, this is the problem with poker, you know? And so I just see poker as this like, you know, beautiful game that's like meant to be fun and social. Like, yeah, maybe let's give up some, you know, like obviously everyone's EV goes way down. Like we trade money for, you know, with variance for
just
the
like
next 30 minutes. Yeah, whatever, however long, like, 10
yeah,
minutes. Yeah. Yeah. And then we go home. It's, you know, whatever. And so I just think that there's a lot of times where like people, where things like this happen. And I just think that there's a lot of like poker is like a really great place actually to be social and to express a lot about who we are. And, yeah, I mean, and I know this is a poker podcast, so, yeah, it's just really great to be here talking about this stuff.
Yeah. It's inspiring to hear this from you. Definitely going to be more conscientious about my, you know, table presence and what I want to be doing. I also, you know, see myself doing similar things, probably not to the degree or with the level of experience that you have, but for me it's really important to always create a good atmosphere, and I'm naturally a fairly extroverted person, so I'm always kind of talking with people and stuff. But it's, I mean you see it for yourself, like even just from a selfish perspective, like you're playing a cash game and just kind of like guy sits down, like puts in his headphones and like buys mm-hmm. in for the max, and it's like, this guy, he's not here to gamble, you know?
Yeah.
He's here to take your money. And, like, the people that are playing poker, like, I mean, even if someone's drunk, like, no one's dumb. You know, no one's, like, yeah. No one's dumb to think, like, this guy isn't here to do that. Where, like, there's, like, little stuff that I do where it's, you know, it's not like leaving Evie on the table, but it's something where it's, like, maybe my first few hands, I just buy in for what they bought in for. And then, like, I lose a pot, and then I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, like, I need to, like, get it all back yeah. and put it in. So it's, like, okay. so I miss, you know, I don't cover someone for like two hands mm-hmm. or something where everyone's like obsessed with covering someone or like
yeah.
all this shit where it's like if just like half of this stuff people thought about sometimes, like the games would be so much better.
Yeah.
People would just not leave when they leave.
There's an epic thread on 2+2.
Yeah.
Do you know Billy?
Yeah.
I play a lot with Billy.
Oh, so I don't know him personally, but okay. I mean the thread is like by far, I was going to ask you about that next. It's like the biggest informer of like my beliefs in regards to this. Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
he's Billy's the best man, yeah. and I because he plays a lot. I play in Southern California a lot with him, and
yeah,
he's just like an artist at it. Like he creates a space for people to gamble and have fun always, and you know, like he gets a ton of action, and the game is always good. People want to play with him, and it's a great. He's a great model for what poker should be like yeah. and how fun it can be. So, yeah, I mean, and if you guys haven't heard about the thread, maybe you could like post in the comments or something where people could like follow that thread. Cause I think it's a really great read too, where he talks a lot about his journey and a lot of those things.
Yeah. We'll definitely put it, in the show notes. I know on our social media, we link to it every now and then,
okay, yeah,
because it's just like, this is, yeah. It's the end-all, be-all thread for this type of stuff.
Yeah.
So, Jack, are you playing in casino games in New York, or are you doing, like, private games? How do you guys play your poker out there?
It's just me living out here, and I just found, like, the nut private game. Rake out here tends to be really, really bad, but I'm in a game where some nights it's a flat fee, which ends up being pretty reasonable. And then when it's not a flat fee, it's a 5% up to 10, which is just like way better than anything else you'll find in the city. So no, it's not a casino game. It's a private game. It's not something I could necessarily bring anyone to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good group of guys and girls, mostly much older than I am, which actually is pretty interesting in terms of the conversation you guys were just having. Like, it's a fairly politicized group. Some people across the spectrum of politics, although mostly Jewish, are political beliefs. I'm personally always very reluctant to share my opinions just because I'm so much younger. And I think my experience in those sorts of conversations with people who are older is that people are not that interested in hearing what the youngest person, especially by the degree to which I'm younger than them, has to say, unless I'm directly asked. So I'm going to be pretty reserved in those games, at least in terms of political discussion, and more active in terms of poker discussion.
Yeah, that's probably wise.
especially when you're not guaranteed a seat in that game. But I was going to say, at least specifically in like New York Jewish culture, which I'm intimately familiar with, talking about politics is definitely more kind of okay.
Oh yeah.
If anything, it's what you do. Like I forgot that it's not, I didn't realize until I was like almost going to college that like, it's not a thing that necessarily like every extended family gathering for other people, you just like talk about politics most of the time.
Yeah.
It's no one's like super pro Trump, but you have a lot of like very fiscally conservative people and some flaming liberals, and a deep desire to discuss politics and not really resolve anything. But an educated group, a lot of lawyers, bankers. pretty much exactly what you'd expect here.
Man, I hope you keep your seat in this game.
I will. I mean, I'm perpetually owed money, which has been good. It means I get to come back.
Nice.
Just like, oh, I can give you the rest in 20s. Oh, don't worry about it. Just give it to me next time.
But yeah, on any given day, I'm definitely not guaranteed a seat since it's one table. And I would not be surprised if I'm the last person to have their seat guaranteed. Like, normally they'll text me and say, like, do you want to play? And I'll be like, yeah. And they'll say, okay, I'll let you know tomorrow if I have a seat for you. Which I think is pretty wise on their parts. Like, I'm pretty much only valuable to the game, I think, if it's in lieu of an empty seat, even though I think I'm a pretty friendly guy. Just both because of my demographic, and I think I'm perceived to be a skilled player.
Yeah, you're putting that very politely, but like, also too, like having like a very good player in a private game can be very costly to the people that are running it. If you're like wrecking the players that are there every day, you know, they're probably less likely to want to come play.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the thing is it's that hasn't been the case. I'll just say that. Like, exactly. It's pretty much the same pool of like 15 or 20 players, a different permutation of that every week. And it doesn't seem like one. What's so great about this game is that I think everyone kind of thinks of themselves as like a good player because they're a, you know, generally very smart, successful person. And so they like the idea of having the challenge of like someone who they sort of perceive as a pro. I don't say that I'm a pro. I don't even think of myself as a poker pro right now, but I think I'm perceived definitely to be a pro.
Just
they enjoy that challenge.
You make all that good jazz money that lets you live on the upper west side. Yeah.
That's something else too that I was gonna actually bring up. It just brings up a point that when at Zach and I's table at Binion's, kind of what you're sharing, Jack, about, you know, being a, like kind of like a semi-pro in the game, or however you want to define it, or probably like the most skilled player in the game, or one of them. You really want to create not just an environment that's like conducive and friendly and open to where like people feel good playing there, but like a hand came up where this guy like limp min re-raised and like played this hand like about as bad as you could play a hand for as many big blinds. Remember the ace king hand, the guy had a set of fours.
Oh my god, yeah.
So the hand is not even that important. Really just know that like it's about as bad as you could mess up a hand for about as many chips as you could ever imagine. So yeah, it was really bad. And there's like a tremendous, it's like having the like just the awareness that this guy is like devastated right now about this huge mistake that he made, and he's like kind of commenting on it and feeling really badly. I think like I try to do my best to like be compassionate with the guy. And so like he's kind of talking about it, and I was like, yeah man, I mean, you know, those big bet sizings are really like, they're kind of like the nuts or nothing a lot of times. Yeah. You know, to like make him feel like not so stupid about it. And I think that kind of stuff goes a really long way. And one thing that is like probably my biggest pet peeve in all of poker is when like one good reg looks at the other good reg and like rolls his eyes or starts laughing.
Oh my god, like, I hate that so much.
Yeah, and like I do like the exact opposite, because I think, you know, first of all, that's a tremendous amount of value for any game. But second of all, like just as a human being, like I've been there where I've like made a huge mistake and I felt really dumb about it. And you know, if like a good player like mentioned something or like however this like looks, I think it can go a long way. So yeah, I just thought that was really interesting to like as far as like the way the hand was played and the comment I made. And I guess not really interesting, it's more like my pet peeve when people when they do that thing where they're like, oh my god, this guy, and they like act like that. It's like that's the thing that will like set me off. Like I'll flip the table over if I see that. That's like number one.
Yeah, it's you're basically just like, I want to like share this like moment with this other reg that will last 2 seconds, that will leave a burning impression why one of the biggest, you know, losers in the game shouldn't come back.
Like, yeah,
just idiotic.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I think I agree with both of you guys in a lot of ways. I'm not at all saying that the pros should just like look at each other and roll their eyes. Like, I don't think that's good in any way. I don't think that helps anybody. But I'll just play a little bit of devil's advocate in terms of some of the conversation that's being had here about the sort of best thing to do being to keep the fish ignorant of the fact that they're fish. And I'm just wondering like what you guys think about that. Because when we're talking about stuff like not having the game break immediately after the guy leaves, like, yeah, is that like potentially embarrassing for this guy if everyone leaves as soon as he's done? It's like, oh, obviously they were all just here to play with me. But you could easily make the argument that it's in that person's best interest to realize that they're losing money at a rate that's like supporting this game, and maybe they don't want to be doing that. Or like if they make this really, really stupid call, or just totally put your hand, and then you have Andrew here like consoling you and saying like, oh, that was challenging. Like anyone could have made that mistake. Like you could easily look at that in a much more negative way and say like, you're basically keeping these people in like a state of blissful ignorance so that they'll come back and keep giving you money. And I don't see it like that, but I also don't see it quite as rosy. It's not quite as rosy to me as it seems to be to you guys. I'm wondering like what your thoughts are on that perspective.
I definitely hear you there. I think it's a good like counter argument. Where I feel like really passionately about it is that two things. The first and most important thing is that I think a lot about like culturally, like the game culture and like being, as I mentioned earlier, like leading with who I want to be and leading with like creating with what I want to create, which is like a place where like people can like have fun and they can gamble and like not feel stupid about mistakes. So like that's generally my come from when it comes to stuff like this. The other thing that I'll add, because I've played a lot in Vegas where, you know, like the guys that come in, they're on vacation, like the whales that come there, they have a lot of money because, mm-hmm. You know, they at least put on that they have a lot of money. And it's really believable a lot of times the way that these guys go through money. And they just want to like fucking sit down and be entertained and gamble. They know they're the spot, you know, but they're going to get in there and they're going to mix it up. And I think that a lot of these guys, like they're successful people. They're very smart. They yeah. know they're the mark. You know, but the reason why poker will always be fine is because people love to gamble and they have a false sense of like, probably like how, maybe they don't realize how bad they are, but they know that they're losing because it's pretty obvious to them, you know, in their bank accounts or whatever that, and a lot of guys that I know that play in my player pool in San Diego, they track every year and they
live in San Diego.
Well, I split my time between Vegas and San Diego. I was there for 2 years.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. And so they'll know, like a couple of the guys too, some of the recreational players, they have like a stop loss for the year. And, you know, those are like some of the more responsible guys. But basically, to kind of summarize like my thoughts on this, I think that I believe you should really try to like put forth and be and create the kind of culture and the environment that you can and just like lead with that. And also that... a lot of these like bad players are very aware of like that they're losers in the game and they're not winner. And and I don't think it's perfect. I agree with you, Jack. I think, you know, there is like a level of deception there when I do that. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely some self gain there that could be definitely like scrutinized.
I really like all that, and I think to me, the one thing that changes this from just other basic like customer service situations, where I do think like poker professionals offer like an entertainment product that has definite value to people who like to come gamble and have a social experience, and I think it's a totally reasonable and moral and fun transaction. And the only thing that really complicates that is the element of addiction, which is, you know, something that I guess like morally poker or people who play poker for a profit and can be very certain of their edge and do things like provide customer service to people who are potentially suffering various degrees of addiction. I suffer might be the wrong word, but are definitely addicted to one degree or another. That's just the one thing that you kind of have to come to terms with in some way, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, poker is, it's, like, very beautiful and creative, and it's, like, all these amazing things that I've, like, grown my life around, but there's also, like, just like anything else, there's a dark side to it where, like, some people get lost in it. And I've been lost in, like, numerous things living in Vegas I lived there for 10 years. But it doesn't like, for me, it doesn't like change the love that I have for the game. Mm-hmm. But I just recognize that, as Jack mentions, there is like, there are these like certain players that come in and just like addicted, losing their businesses or whatever, their lives.
Yeah.
And this is a part of the culture. It is a part of the game, you know, and it's the part that like I tend to like pretend like doesn't exist. But it's also really difficult for me to know which people are in there doing it responsibly and which ones are not being responsible. I can make my judgments, but like, fuck, I don't know.
Yeah, you never know. Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a lot of shades of gray here. Like, I think a lot of people that aren't in the poker world aren't like in the gambling world and hear that, you know, I gamble and play poker professionally. Like, a big common thing is like, oh, like, are you addicted? And I honestly answer, like, in many ways, yes. You know, like, I'm addicted to, like, you know, luckily I'm more addicted to, like, understanding poker and strategy and thinking about the game than I am to, like, swings of lots of money. I actually don't particularly love that aspect of the game. I like the strategy more. But there's a lot of people that are just addicted to, like, the social experience, or maybe, like, you know, there's probably a lot of just, like, single retirees, single widowed, or like widowers, like people whom their social experience is in poker, and like they're losing players on some level, and like, yeah, would it be better for them to find something else? Do they like not like the fact that they're losing money? Like, of course they don't, but also like, this is, there's so many people where I'm sure even if they're losing money, their life situation is better, and you just don't know. Like, maybe they're single and like dwindling down like their entire savings, or maybe like they do it responsibly and it's like completely works for them. They lose on average $10 an hour, and like that's like so worth it for them. Like,
yeah,
it's really hard to put yourself in people's shoes when you don't know their, you know, situation.
I'm a firm believer that if you're gonna make shit up, like make up the good shit, you know, like on anything, you know, like I can have my thoughts about like, you know, why like my wife is like unhappy with me, or like why this girl broke up with you. Like, you don't know, you know? So like most people go to like worst case scenario always. They're like, oh, it's because I'm not this enough, that enough. But like, I just make up like best case scenario. I'm like, well, I mean, I'm just like, you know, she was really insecure around me. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm just too cool. Or, you know, I mean, obviously I'm joking.
I'm sure that's it. Yeah.
Obviously I'm joking there, but I think, you know, if I'm going to make shit up about like people at the poker table, like I'm going to make up that they're fine. Like, this guy is like, he's a smart dude. He's got money. Like, he's going to be fine. I'm not going to make up like his children are at home. No money. I'm going to go there and like give them like $20 so they can go get McDonald's, you know? So, I mean, obviously I'm using extremes here, but I like to, if I can't have answers to things, I'd like to think of like in a very positive way, typically.
Yeah. I'm sure Jack is just laughing over here. Jack and I diverge a little bit on this. I'm very much of your mindset, and we definitely were exposed to each other's ways of approaching life on this. We kind of drove across the country and spent like 2 months straight with each other, kind of on the road. So
you get to know each other pretty well after that, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I like to think I see the world maybe more as it is than as it should be. But I do think there's a lot of benefits to sort of just, or to the optimistic worldview in general. I mean, there's been a lot shown that optimists are better with dealing with adversity, more resilient, all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, has value. And I think in this situation where it's like, you know, we're all very passionate about the poker. We love the social element. We like playing the game. And yeah, neither the, you know, everyone is here responsibly, and everyone is here like and is a total degenerate and is ruining their lives playing poker. Neither of those are true in many situations at all.
Well, you were talking about like seeing the world as it is too, which I think that's a really, like, I've done that a lot, and that has actually led to me to, like, have, like, I'm a somewhat depressive type person, and I think it's a lot of times when I go to that, like, see the world as it is kind of mentality. And so maybe this is some, like, elaborate defense mechanism that I have to, like, you know, not go to that, like, negative place, which is you know, like seeing like the good side and things, and like really leaning into like what I know is good rather than like, you know, seeing, taking things for what I believe they are a lot, which is,
right,
you know, in this current world and like a lot of the things that I've seen as I've in my life, I think is like led me to like some pretty like unhappy places. But I mean, and it's, you know, it's hearing you talk about it and share it, it's like, I don't think it's necessarily a wrong or a bad way to look at things. I just know where I go when I kind of go down that road.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, I think another thing to realize is that, like, you might think there's a difference between, like, we all might personally see a difference between, like, the most optimistic outlook and what we kind of consider to be a real outlook. But we also have to realize that, like, whatever we think that real outlook is really just another perspective that has very little probably to do with the quote-unquote truth. And it's, I think, in many cases best just to go with, like, one, the most self-serving, and two, the best serving for society, or at least it's like, you know, as best we can judge outlook, rather than what we think is the real outlook, if neither of those are probably correct. Anyway, that's one thing. But the thing I was going to mention that I totally forgot about is that the other issue in terms of taking a moral stand in poker is that, like, how many situations, like, it's just another tragedy of a common situation where, like, yeah, sure, you can remove yourself from the situation, but you're not really helping anything. So as long as it's, like, not so egregiously, like, immoral, and I definitely don't think it is, like, have your fun, make your money. Like, I think I'm doing good things with the money that I make from poker, and I think I'm giving people a good experience. And even if I'm in a small way fostering some addictions, like, I don't think, like, being addicted to poker is the worst form of being addicted to gambling. And it's not like the game wouldn't be there if I wasn't there.
That's a good point. That's what I, that's the thing that, like, allowed me to be in poker as long as I have, was that, and when I first started in my career, I would, like, check back hands that I knew I had the best hand because I felt bad when I first started in poker. And I was like, I really struggled with it. I know that sounds crazy. And I would talk to my wife about it all the time. And the thing that, like, initially allowed me to break through that was that I realized that, like, the guy or girl that's sitting there that's going to give their money away, if they don't give it to me, they're going to give it to Zach when he sits down in my chair behind me. Yeah. So, like, I'm just, like, one piece to this puzzle.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that's the attitude that's, like, contributing to global warming and, like, all of our environmental crises.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the things that are really bad in the world. But
that's true. Like, that's a good point. Yeah. So
economic
I'm a terrible person.
Are real, you know?
I'm just joking. No, well, you're right,
though. Yeah, I mean, there's no consensus on global warming. We don't need to.
Yeah, let's start and turn this to a global warming podcast.
Yeah. We definitely have listeners who I'm sure are falling in that camp. And, you know, I think Zach and I both respectfully disagree with those views, but hopefully you're still listening and enjoying this enough and our sort of hyper-liberal selves, like, aren't coming out too strongly for your tastes, because we do value your listenership. Yeah.
On that note, Andrew has, in 45 minutes, has to get back to Binion's to crush this soft field. And I don't want to take too much of his time. It was such a pleasure having you here, speaking with you, having you on the podcast. I feel really grateful that you came over. This was awesome.
I appreciate it, guys. I mean, what I told Zach when he asked me initially is, like, I just love this. I love talking about poker. I love, especially, like, debating, you know, having, like, any kind of back and forth with people that are open, intelligent, and, you know, especially about this game that we love. So I was excited. I'm, you know, very grateful to be here, and hopefully I can, you know, close out this tournament. It'd be pretty sweet.
Okay.
I'll do it in your name, because I know I have a lot of your chips that weren't supposed to be mine equity wise, but
Andrew, quickly, is there any way that you would like for our listeners potentially engage with you on social media? Do you have any books, videos? Do you have a favorite YouTube video or flavor of ice cream that you'd like people to try? Anything you want to plug, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so I did coach for Ivy League for a while when they were going. So I did videos there, but really, I guess the thing that, if I could say, like, one thing is, like, I'm doing a lot with my wife now. Like, she does this, like, WTF Am I Doing With My Life podcast, where she talks about, like, life and poker and all these other things. But yeah, I mean, really, really on there, like, we shared a lot. Like, we did mushrooms on one of the episodes. Like, it was like a, like, experience for us. We were at, like, Glacier National Park, and it's all kinds of, like, you know, just like random, like, what the fuck am I doing with my life moments. So
yeah,
it's cool to be a part of that. But yeah, so, and then I'm on Twitter, Amo for show. And yeah, if you guys want to follow me, I post, like, poker chip porn pictures and random thoughts about poker sometimes. So that's it.
Love me some chip porn. So, awesome, Andrew. Thank you again for spending an hour and a half with us. Good luck at the tournament.
Thank you, Jack. It's nice meeting you.